Recovery Elevator, episode 476.
What I really like now about sobriety, frankly, is I just try everything. Just try it once.
Welcome to the Recovery Elevator podcast. My name is Paul Churchill, and I'm so excited to be here with you today. Listeners, on today's episode, we have Tanya. She's 50 years old, from St. Paul, Minnesota, and took her last drink on August 28th, 2021. Great job, Tanya. I want to say thank you to all of our Cafe Ari chat hosts. You guys are my superheroes. And listeners, today is going to be a good day. I can feel it. Registration is now open for our flagship alcohol-free retreat, which takes place in the beautiful Rocky Mountains south of Bozeman, Montana. This takes place August 14th to the 18th, and we are coming together as a group who have ditched the booze and want to create a better life. Now, I do anticipate this event filling up fast, so please don't wait. There are shared cabins available, or you can stay in the infamous Tent City at a lower rate. Check out the link in the show notes for more information. Thank you, Robin. And now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp.
When trying to explain some symptoms of depression to my husband, I used an analogy that my therapist talked to me about. Imagine that you have a set amount of spoonfuls of energy every day. When you are experiencing depression, simple tasks like brushing your teeth or combing your hair may require more spoons than usual, so you run out easily and feel drained. Now I can say, hey, I've got only one spoon left today. I don't have energy to go to that party. And he gets what I mean. Therapy really has provided me tools to communicate my feelings better. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/elevator today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/elevator.
Okay, let's get started. The question we are going to answer for the next 7 to 8 minutes is quitting drinking hard? My response is it can be to yes, but if you do have a drinking problem, quitting drinking is way easier than riding alcohol off into the sunset of self-destruction and what could be called a slow suicide. Okay, is quitting drinking hard? Well, that's different for everyone, but I think the consensus here is yes, it's a bit of a challenge, and here are some reasons why. But stick with me after this list. I'm going to give you reasons why it's way harder to keep drinking than to quit drinking. All right, quitting drinking can be hard because, number one, your body has to detoxify itself from the chemical alcohol. If anyone has quit sugar or processed foods cold turkey, it's a similar experience, but alcohol is much worse because alcohol is one of the only substances on the planet where you can die from stopping cold turkey. That's a big asterisk. If you're trying to quit drinking, be very careful stopping cold turkey. Now, the pain game of detox usually happens within the first 72 hours. Think night sweats, brain fog, uneasy stomach, the shits, and way more. Alcohol for president. Number two, quitting drinking can be hard because you're going to have to learn some new routines and make some new habits. But good news here, humans are extremely good at coping with change and making change, especially when your survival depends on it. So you can do this. So if your witching hour is from 5 to 6 p.m., then you may have to place yourself on a pickleball court, preferably with a racket and ball in tow. Another idea would be to go to a meeting or a chat. Number three, quitting drinking can be hard because when you first explore an alcohol-free life, you probably don't have a good sober buddy on speed dial. Now this part, the connection component, can take some time, but it's also the most fulfilling and rewarding part about sobriety as well. Number four, quitting drinking can be hard because we live in a drunk world. Well, not everybody is kung fu fighting, but you get the point. It can feel like we're swimming upstream, and hello, stigma. Quitting drinking can be hard, number five, because of boredom. We are conditioned to think that we are doing something wrong when we find ourselves bored, But science and studies show that boredom is very normal and part of a healthy life experience. Now, sure, that list could go on of why quitting drinking is hard, but in reality, any significant life change comes with its challenges. And I think we can all agree when we look back, some of the most rewarding outcomes of life were the ones that had the most challenges at first. There's really no difference here. To summarize, and we want to keep this podcast real, is yes, quitting drinking can be hard, even to very hard. But do you know what's way harder than quitting drinking? And I mean to the 100th degree, is to keep on drinking. Now, if you have a drinking problem, the hardest thing you will ever do is to keep on drinking. Now, there are some stark consistencies on this podcast that we have seen with the interviews. The most relevant here is the progression of alcoholism or the disease, if that's what you want to call it. Now, I can unequivocally say a drinking problem will not do a self-reversal and improve on its own. In fact, it only gets worse. To let that freight train of destruction to keep going forward unchecked is hands down way more painful than quitting drinking. This is a slow suicide. As 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant says, we all have a duty to our fellow human beings to be the best version of ourselves as possible. You being dragged down into the abyss of addiction is horrible for you, but also those around you. Yes, the last 159 words were a bit grim, but it's the truth. You not quitting drinking is way harder than you quitting drinking. That's definitely a line that you want to insert into your subconscious daily. That drinking, that keeping this act up, is harder than quitting drinking. Now, let's end this intro on a bright note, because there are some truths about quitting drinking that are so glorious, magnificent, miraculous indeed. And once you reach a certain point, quitting drinking might even be easy. Number one, once you get over the hump of detox and brain fog, I'd say give yourself at least 14 to 21 days. You're going to say, my holy goodness, I've been asleep for the last couple decades. You're going to want more of that new good feeling. Number two, living alcohol free is the most major act of self-care you can do for yourself. It feels good to treat yourself so lovingly. Number three, the storm will settle. No more checking text messages to see what you said the night before. You'll remember the pages of the book you read last night. You're going to have less sick days at work. Your mornings are no longer going to suck because you're not hungover, less dents in your car, and more money in your bank account. Lots more. Another magnificent thing that happens is your dopamine system will rebalance. The ice bath craze works like this. You voluntarily put yourself on the pain side of the scale by sitting in freezing cold water. Then the dopamine dam breaks and you feel great for an extended period of time. With alcohol, it's the exact opposite, but a way worse ratio. You feel good at first, and sometimes this is for only 30 minutes. Then hello pain the remaining hours, and then well into the hours of the next day. It's an absolute horrible trade-off. The feel-good to pain ratio with alcohol is atrocious. In fact, if alcohol were a stock or a bond, it would be rated triple junk, double dog doo-doo, straight up shit. The next glorious thing about living life alcohol-free is you're living life at face value, and that alone should make you happy. For roughly 10,000 human generations, this was the norm. Only the past 300 to 400 years has such escapism been a thing. When we live life at face value, only then can we start to build a life that no longer requires alcohol. I hope you guys enjoyed this intro. Before we hear from Tanya, let's hear from Go Brewing.
Go Brewing is redefining the non-alcoholic craft beer landscape, and we are thrilled to have them as a partner on our podcast. Since launching in 2023, they've become a standout, fulfilling almost 25,000 orders across the U.S. and creating an impressive array of 23 distinct beer varieties. Their expertise hasn't gone unnoticed. Go Brewing won the gold and silver medals from the prestigious Best of Craft Beer Awards for their innovative brews, Suspended in a Sunbeam Pils and Sunshine State Tropical Hazy IPA. Innovation is at their core, and they are pushing the boundaries of beer crafting. This includes pioneering gluten-free beer, like their wellness-infused Freedom Chill, enriched with ashwagandha and L-theanine. Their latest sensation? A double IPA that's a hit with beer enthusiasts, brimming with Mosaic, Citra, and Simcoe hops. And here's something special for our listeners. Save 15% off with the code ELEVATOR, plus free two-day shipping on orders of 3 6-packs or more. That's right, order it today, and in 2 days, it will be at your doorstep. Go Brewing is more than a brand for many. Their beer is a tool for people who want the experience without the alcohol. If you missed it, you can save 15% off with the code ELEVATOR, plus free two-day shipping on orders of 3 6-packs or more.
Recovery Elevator, please help me welcome Tanya to the show. Tanya, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. It's spring. Kind of looks like spring outside, sort of, but still spring, so I'm doing well.
Yeah, we only have, like, it only goes up from here. Like, summer's just around the corner.
Yes. I am here for it. Tanya, can you let listeners know how long you've been sober?
I've been sober since August 28th, 2021. So just over 2 years and 6 months and some change.
2.5 years and change. Nice work, sister. How do you feel?
I feel great. It was something I was really unsure if I was going to make it through it. And it was very hard. Probably the hardest thing I ever did in my life. But now I've gone through the storm and I'm really enjoying life, like, to its fullest, which is the goal. So it's great.
30 plus months of freedom. I think that is just amazing. Glad you're here. Before we get into your story, can you let listeners know a little bit about yourself? Where you're from, what you do for a living, any family you want to mention, and most importantly, what do you like to do for fun?
Well, I'm married for 21 years this year. I have two kids, my stepdaughter, who's 21, and my daughter, who's 19. They're both at the University of Minnesota. And for 24 years, I worked in corporate, like, starting up learning and development departments. So education departments within corporations. But now I'm doing a whole new thing. Last summer, I decided I love organizations. So I became an in-home professional organizer. And I love it because it aligns so much with sobriety and everything has a place. And it's amazing when you come out of the fog and you look around and your room is just pizza boxes and empty bottles of booze. It doesn't help you get excited right away. So I've always been really crazy about organization. So that is one of my hobbies for sure. And I do like to cook, and I like to cook things like that are new or hard or something I'm like weird ingredients. I also love to have plants indoor and outdoor and keeping things alive. So that's, you know, I what I really like now about sobriety, frankly, is I just try everything. Just try it once.
I love that. I like that we can embrace our curiosity now, rather than just like protecting our routine and what we feel like we have to do to survive. We can expand ourselves a little bit and try new things. Listeners, we record these over Zoom, and I always like to have cameras on so I can, it's just easier to react. And I am admiring all your plants. I got a little plant.
You know, I haven't killed any of these, and I can't tell you all the names of them. I just picked the ones that I know I'm going to keep alive, but it gives you like that indoor outdoor feeling.
We need that up here in the Midwest.
Absolutely.
All right, Tanya, let's do what we came here to do. Let's get into it and talk about your journey with alcohol. Let's start at the beginning. Maybe some early exposure or some first shots at it, whatever you think is appropriate, and then we'll walk forward together.
Okay, sounds great. Like a lot of us, I was born into a family that had already chosen a religious path. And it just so happened my father also grew up in this religion. My grandfather was a minister. And so I kind of look at it a little bit like, you know, the movie Footloose, like there's no drinking, no smoking, no swearing, all of that. Well, it's like that, but there's no fun dance at the end. It's very strict. The church itself has this crazy hierarchy. It's like this God who is a fearful God, then it's your minister, and then it's the men in the congregation and your father, and then women and children. And children right away are told, you know, to be heard, but or to be seen, but not heard. I can't tell you how many times I heard that growing up. And you don't really get to do Sunday school more than four. So five years old, you're right in the congregation. And I was there 7 days a week. So not only did we go to church there, I also went to school there. And so, you know, you're taught you're a sinner from day one. And every night you have to pray for forgiveness. So here you are, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, thinking, I'm a bad person. What am I going to pray for today? You know, sometimes it like became a joke outside. What are you going to pray for tonight? So I think that first level of like, I'm a bad person. I have shame. I have to ask for forgiveness and I can't do it on my own. I have to ask, you know, a higher power. And I think, you know, it was just kind of backwards. And there were a lot of things happening there that I learned later in life that were really destructive for a lot of people. And, you know, I never found another type of God. I just thought everyone had the same God. And so the point of telling this little story is that it really reflected me getting sober. I mean, I was so against AA for years and years and years because of how I grew up. So my sobriety took way too long. But, you know, I got here and this is how I got here. And I'm just thankful. And I don't look back.
Yeah, that's I would say there's some similarities between what you just described, your early experiences with faith or religion and what we thought. I very much as a child thought that God was this being that had its thumb pressed down on me, waiting for me to screw up. And that fear kept me. I was a good kid for a long time until I said to hell with it. And then it went a whole nother way. But that fear and that shame, like, it only worked for so long until I found a way to kind of escape that shame of me being this constantly being told that I'm a certain type of person. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then also I have an alcoholic father at home who rarely goes to church with us. And so not only that, you on the outside, you're having to be something you're not. Like, you don't talk about your home life. You don't say, oh, dad's home hungover. So now you learn that lying's okay. And, you know, it was really important to me. Like, I don't want to hurt my mom and like drag up the past. But I think to truly get sober, you really have to dig in. And I, you know, I got through it and I understand some things and I'm not wanting to go back there or hurt anyone. But it all kind of aligns.
Yeah, that can be a challenge. It's not about placing blame. Or saying I'm this because of this person or because of that person. But also I think it's really helpful to take a look at the experiences that we've had and figure out the impact they had on us. I also, you know, with the program that I practice, I need to extend some grace to those people. I need to forgive them. It just doesn't pay for me to hold on to it. And that, you know, that is a process sometimes.
Absolutely. But
it's a curiosity, analytical sort of thing to understand how we got to where we got.
Yeah, it's hard work, but it always pays off.
Yeah. So that's kind of the stage has been set. That's what early childhood and stuff was like. When did you find yourself kind of dipping your toes in the water and experimenting with alcohol for the first time?
Well, truly, I didn't really drink until college because of maybe I didn't want to turn into an alcoholic like my father or, you know, I, like you, had these all. I was a pretty good person. Like, I did good things. And but I always probably knew I was going to have a relationship with alcohol. And so my first time I drank was at a house party my freshman year in college. You know, I don't know if you, like, in college, they make this like Wapatuli, they call it, where there's all these pretty, pretty bad, low shelf alcohol in a bucket. You don't know what else is in there. And I remember thinking, like, the first time I drank, wow, where has this been all my life? Okay, I have a totally different feeling about this. And it just helped me be more talkative. And I wasn't really shy, but I met a lot of friends and it just let me get loose and just talk to strangers, you know, and now I can talk to strangers sober, which is fabulous. But I never really had an issue with it. I just knew I liked it. I had a lot of goals. I needed to get out of that small town. I was never looking back. So, you know, I did the weekend starting on Thursdays and then Sundays hungover and go to college and finish college. And then I moved to the Twin Cities and get a job. Alcohol was always part of my life. But it didn't really become a problem until my 30s. But when I look back at it, like, I was kind of always the drunkest at the happy hour. And It's just all the things I'm recognizing now. There was never like a time where I thought, yeah, I'm going to go out and have two beers and then go home. It was always like an event. It was a mission. I'm going to get drunk. But it really started to become more of a major problem, actually, in my 30s than into my 40s.
Yeah, I remember visiting. My wife went to college in Northeast Iowa. Go Luther. Anyway, she, I remember at her, it wasn't a sorority house. It was like her and some friends had a like condo that they rented like from the school. Anyway, they made that drink out of a bathtub.
Yeah.
And it's like, what in the hell are we doing? And like, it, I mean, it didn't slow me down by any imagination, but I'm like, well, I'm dipping a ladle in a tub here. What's going on?
Yeah. And all these like gross frat boys putting together your cocktail of the night. Now, you know, it makes me like, what a gag, but you know, back then you're, who cares?
But yeah, it was like, for what you said, so many people have said this on the show before that I can talk to people, and I've, you know, I've kind of struggled with that before. And it's that early recognition that this does something for me. We're seeing a benefit. We want to be able to do something, and this kind of opens the door to that.
So true.
It's so easy to kind of ignore the negatives. And I think a lot of times, like at that age, the negatives for a lot of people are pretty minimal. I won't say they're non-existent, but you recover quickly. You know, you're young. It's absolutely socially acceptable. So it's hard to see a downside, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think of my 20s like fun. You know, I really thought I was a great karaoke singer, and like I would get the crowd going. I had my own dance moves, you know, those types of things I would never do sober. But I met a lot of my friend base at college from just like being drinking. Like you feel that camaraderie, which at that age, I think it's okay. But not all of us turn out like we grow. Some of us grow up and some of us stay there. It's like, yeah. I never wanted the party to end. But unfortunately, it does, and it doesn't always end well.
Yep, I feel you. All right, so college was just kind of like a college experience, right? You mentioned that among your peers that you were always a little, maybe a little more excited or took things a little bit further. Did anybody ever approach you about those situations?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I had a group of girlfriends that I met when I moved here, and eventually they started to phase out of my life because of how I would act. Like when we'd go places, you know, we'd go down for a weekend trip to a casino or go see a band, and like they'd have to bring me back to the hotel room, and I became like a liability. And that's later in my 20s. And I guess I just didn't understand, like, why am I doing this? I'm missing out, but like, I just didn't know how to stop. And that's the problem, I think, with alcohol. It's like, you think more and more and more, you're going to have these feelings or they're going to come back. And really, as we know, the first times you drink of that feeling, rarely you don't get it back. So, So yeah, I lost a lot of friends, and that was just meant to be. And since then I've gotten sober and apologized, you know, and my amends, and you know, we're still friendly, but I don't blame them.
Yeah, that's a tough spot to be, to kind of see people create a bit of that distance. And I don't know, I think a lot of times we probably don't want to face it. And maybe we either chalk it up to something else. We seek out a peer group that, you know, with something a little more in common with the things that we want to do. Or we lean into that. We can lean into that cure a little bit more, right? And it could also be a reason for a little uptick in usage.
Yeah, I think I kind of was starting to know later in my life, like, okay, I want to get married. I want to have children. You know, this isn't realistic. And, you know, I just laid off a little bit, and then those things started to happen. And like, I had a little break in drinking. But yeah, like in my younger years, even in my 30s, when I was traveling for work, I would seek out those people at the hotel bar. I mean, like we were like buddies, like, you know, drunks find other drunks. And so I'm not like, my story didn't end there, but I think that That situation with the friends, really, if I look back at it now, it really was, should have told me, I should have been like, yeah, this is kind of nuts. You're losing friends. And now you're in a whole new, your next chapter of life, and you're in a strange city trying to find people to drink with just so you have someone to talk to. And, you know, then it became, you know, a real problem.
Let's keep going. Let's walk forward to, in this stage, you know, aside from the friendships and the development that happened there, what other consequences?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that happen from 18 to 30, but I don't, you know, I got an underage drinking ticket, you know, in the dorms, and a lot of bad decisions were made, you know, when you're drinking. But I kind of slid by. And then, you know, after my daughter was born, she was born in 2004. I was experiencing a lot of postpartum, just depression. Like, depression has always been something that I've had. It's like depression and addiction, they're like friends, you know, they hang out, like it's crazy. You know, there's a lot of similarities with people who do end up with a drinking problem because they can't figure out what's going on in my head. So after she was born, I decided to kind of go back to drinking because drinking was a solution for me at that time. I found it a great solution for all coping skills. And I mean, now I know that's a fake solution, but, and I started off slow. I mean, my daughter was just the greatest baby. She slept through the night in 3 months. And so I just started drinking to numb the pain. I also had started a different job, same career, but different company. And that was like the major downfall. I mean, I had a really, really horrible boss. The company itself had just was horrible ethics. Ultimately, I poured the drink in my mouth, but boy, the things around me during that phase from like 34 to 43 were bad. So my first DWI was in 2007 when I was 34. And I think I'd never had one. I didn't know the consequences of it. And I got to go home. I blew like a .15 or something. And so someone was able to pick me up and I didn't have to stay in jail. I thought, okay, everybody gets these DWIs. Okay, it happens. Don't feel great about it. Could have hurt somebody, could have hurt myself. And then a couple of years later, I decide to, okay, I'm a mess. And my family's starting to tell me that you really need to, what, your drinking's kind of out of control. And no more so, my mom is taking my daughter and I'm planning a whole weekend just around alcohol. Like, where am I going to go? Who am I going to be with? And after a few of those, you start to feel like, what really am I doing? I have a little baby. So my first trip to rehab was when I was 37. And it was, I went to Hazleton, but I had no idea about the 12 steps. And I'd heard the 12 steps before. I guess I really thought that you just go and there's some magic potion or something. You know, it's Hazleton. I mean, didn't Eric Clapton go there? And I was kind of naive to what was going to happen. But I had already arranged it. Of course, when I'm drinking, you know, call them up and yes, then tell all my family. And the next morning, I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? So everybody's on board like, yay, Tanya's going to rehab. And little did they know, I would try it six more times. So seven rehabs. But I think this starts where I realize that the 12 steps are part of the program. And I am just like bawling. I'm like, get me out of here. If this is your foundation, because I couldn't get over, well, I couldn't even get over the first step. I mean, I'm like, I am not powerless over anything. I am very successful in life, you know. And then, you know, as the steps go on, you know, six out of the 12 refer to God. And of course, people are coming in trying to calm me down. Oh, there's so much more to it. You know, you can have a higher power. I'm like, I don't even know what a higher power is. Get me out of here. And I stayed for the 28 days, but, you know, it just, I didn't know what I was getting into. And I really didn't understand how much work I had to do. And, you know, it was nice. They do have a beautiful meditation room and the food is wonderful. So I'm always looking forward to breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But I kind of knew that I was just going to go back to drinking when I got out.
Yeah. It's crazy to think now, just with with some time in sobriety and the amount of experiences that we've had, you know, collectively, just the exposure we receive once we're in it. But you mentioned just being scared, or maybe a little naive, and like, yeah, same. Like when I went to treatment, I did a outpatient, and I thought maybe they'll just teach me to drink the way that I want to.
Right.
Like I'm going to freaking rehab, and I think I'm going to learn how to drink. Like, no, dummy, that's not what this is. But like my only frame of reference was pop culture, and that wasn't even, I don't, I think it's gotten better in the past few years, maybe, but it was nothing, just how little I knew.
I knew nothing. I mean, I don't know. I would never go into something like that. Like, and then, you know, the steps, they're so gray. I'm like, well, I want a checklist. I want to be able to graduate from this program. And over life, you know, I had to learn that, like, you don't get that. And that was really hard. And also, you know, I think all the rehabs were very informative. I learned a lot about the psychology behind why I drink. And, you know, I went to the Mayo Clinic and that was wonderful. So I learned that I'm drinking poison and all the things that it's doing to my body. And literally, you have a fatty liver and your liver levels are here. So that was fascinating. But I also, I don't know, this came to me like just when I started to get sober, like we're all crazy, like in rehab. None of us have 30 days, not one person. We all come in usually drunk. And so here you are with crazy people trying to get sober and things are happening and you still don't know why you're there. And so AA just really at the end of the day, or community in general, where people have different levels of sobriety. That's when I really started to learn the real practical things in life that you need to do. And, you know, rehab, I kept all my stuff and I pull it out sometimes, even like when I try and come up with a topic at Cafe RE for hosting, I'm like, this is a good topic. Let's talk about shame. But I think I just needed that practicality. Like, you know, Joe has 30 years of sobriety. What did he do? Like, let's do those things. Yeah. And then later on in life, then you get into, well, why did I do the psychology of it? And so I was doing it all wrong, I think.
Yeah, I think each of these elements, like they have their place, right? And I think I had, was my counselors who worked for the treatment center. So, but I believe what they told me that for me, what treatment was this kind of immersive experience. I was coming from a life with really no exposure to recovery or sobriety. So that's what my extended length of outpatient rehab was all about, was exposure. And, you know, it was a guaranteed exposure as long as I showed up multiple days a week to this, some of the science behind it, a little bit of tips and tricks, some group chat. And like you said, everybody, like we all showed up and we were all screwed up. We had no length of sobriety, but like we're all in it together, right? And
there is this
beautiful little alumni of people who are like, what in the hell is going on with my life? But yeah, I am similar to you. I had to, we'll just call it, graduate into a community that had a little bit of everything. You know, some people with some longer term. And also, like, new people still coming in, too.
Yeah, I mean, that mix is really powerful, especially once you get more sobriety under your belt. And then now you're just not the newbie. Now this person behind you. So it's a really great evolution of community and where you start and where you end. And, you know, I still talk to my roommate who I met at Hazleton. This is 2010. And she took the cure. She got it. And I didn't. So it's everybody's story for recovery is so different. But we all have common themes, like we want to figure it out. And I think that's where I found the most value is the community portion of it.
Yeah. So we got a bit of time left, but I want to make sure we get to, you know, you've got 2.5 years. So I want to hear about that. You mentioned, all right. So that was your first time going into treatment. You also mentioned that you had a few attempts at it. Let's walk up to just what was leading up to August of 2021. What, just paint the picture of kind of like where things were and what it was that made that August 28th your day.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to summarize, but from 38 age to 41, I was put in on a psychiatric hold twice for talking about suicide. You know, I hadn't actually done anything. I think that was like a cry for help. So that happened. And then by the time I was 42, I was trying to quit. And now at this point, I'm addicted physically. So I had my first seizure related to alcohol withdrawal. In 2016 was my second DWI. And I'm in, you know, there, county jail, thinking I get to go home. No, well, I blew a 0.39. And yeah, that's pretty serious. And no, so I had to stay for the weekend. And that was a new experience. And 43, when I was 43, I went to detox, not wanting to go to this detox. It's like the county detox. But, you know, my family had no idea what to do with me and all these things. They're thinking, you know, that's going to help her. And then I lost my job finally in 2018. And I think, you know, the description was a paragraph long, not even related to alcohol. But by that time, I'm physically addicted to it and I'm drinking on the job. And I'm sure I just reek of alcohol in these meetings. And so that's like when things started to change. Like, okay, I've lost my job now. So the rest of 2018, I'm trying really vigorously to get back into the workforce, finding it very difficult. And then I just turned to, I don't know, just drinking. So I laid in bed and drank for a whole year. I mean, my whole existence. It was like I'm Bill Murray in Groundhog's Day every day, except I had two things: drink, fall back to sleep, drink, fall back to sleep. And like my biggest complication in my mind is, how am I going to get liquor in this house? Because I can't drive, but you know, delivery is available. And you know, the whole you hide liquor, you have it. Well, for me, it was like a living or dying situation. So I had it everywhere. I mean, anywhere I could put it. And then I think all of 2019 was just suffering. And you know, I kind of had succumbed to the idea I'm going to die from this disease. I just didn't think it would be by suicide. I thought I'll probably fall down the stairs, I'm sure, or I'll just overdose in alcohol. And then when I had this very crystal clear moment in early 2020, where I was at a crossroads that I'd never been at before, it was like, here I am. I obviously can't do the right way. Been to rehab 7 times. I've been in the psych ward. I've been in detox. All these things are happening. And now I'm physically addicted to it. Or I'm just going to go out. And that was really powerful, because I was not a person that ever thought about that in my head when I was sober. But, you know, that night I had some prescription pills that just had gotten filled, like a trazodone for sleeping. And I think I took 2 or 3 minutes and made the choice. Like, this is what I'm doing. I'm taking the out. Mm. And obviously I'm here to talk about it. So I lived, but that one thing in life is something out of all the other things. And not because, oh no, I would have been gone off the earth. I would have been gone, like, right? I would have been over my misery. But you know, my daughter was 15 years old, and I have so much thought about, wow, you thought you were abandoned, you know? Wow, yeah. You just made your abandonment. So that got me on the track. It got me out of bed, and it really changed my whole perspective. I had to do something. And so the day that I got sober, that 28th, it had really nothing to do with anything. It was just a combination of so many things. And I was 2 days like clean. So I still drank up until then, but I was just ready. And so when you hear willingness and surrender, I have no idea how it came to me that day, but all these incidences, but that very last one kind of broke my heart. Like, I couldn't believe I was going to do that. You know, my mom already lost a child, all of those things, you know, come back. And so I'm like, I'm going to AA, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to listen, and I'm going to hear, and I'm going to do everything different. everything in my life. And I did. And then I'd have another day of sobriety. And I went to like 3 meetings a day. Like I was only at meetings. And like, that was my surrendering point. I mean, every rehab or anything I'd been to, AA was always the plan. Now do this for follow-up. I never did it. So, you know, essentially it did save my life, but I don't, you know, I fought it for so long and I finally just like withdrew and said, do whatever it takes. I just need to not ever be back in that dark place.
Yeah, man, that is a lot. And I can just, you know, I've got my version of a lot of your experience and I'm sure a lot of our listeners do. And just hearing you describe it, Tanya, it takes me to some of those moments that I had. And there's like every once in a while, we just hearing somebody else, it kind of brings you back there for a minute. And I just remember that hopelessness and just being in it every day and continuing to like picking up a drink, knowing like I am fucking everything up right now. Like today is going to go bad because I'm picking up another can of beer, or I'm going to buy another case, or whatever that day brought. Like, but just being like, I don't care. I did care, but I'm telling myself that I don't. And I'm just surrendering to this like garbage existence because this is all I deserve, or this is all I'm ever going to have. And it is such a hard place to be and to take steps towards like another way out, like a final way out. That's, I mean, I was on that, the verge of that for a long time. And I'm so glad that you're here. And,
thank you. Yeah. It's hard to talk about it because I feel really ashamed, but suicide and depression, you know, are friends with addiction, like I said before, and I'm not unique. I've heard a lot of stories, and I heard this one woman say once after, she said, if I would have been successful at killing myself, I would have killed the wrong person. Oh. And that just really impacted me. Like, wow. That's right. You know, I never thought about that. I've never thought about it since I've been sober. And yeah, you know, you're not in your right state of mind, especially when you're not even getting out of bed for a year, you know? So it was a horrible way to finally wake up, but that's the way it went. And so many people have the same stories or the same things. And I love when I hear a story when people say, I didn't want to go down that road and I didn't want to have to do all those things. And I realized that I was going down that road. And so it doesn't always have to be a traumatic story for you to turn around. But my life was that. And so can't change it. But I have a great relationship now with my daughter. She would have never known that I drank because of my own. I'm in my head, you know, in the summer she came back from Iowa State, her first year home. Her and I, and that was my first year sober, we spent hours talking. And she said, I thought you drank because of me. And You're really, I mean, kids do that though. You know, when you think the kids are so distraught when parents get divorced. And you know, I wouldn't have had that opportunity to explain to her, no, you're the best thing that's ever happened. And I let her talk about her experiences. I talked about mine and like I was able to heal through her. And that's really amazing when you can have that relationship. But, you know, I was just a step away from.
Like, what a blessing to be able to get to that place, right? Where you can have those conversations with the people that you care about.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's like, I think like the only sad part about that is that she didn't go to University of Iowa, that she went to Iowa State. But, you know, like everybody's got their own path. But. No, way to ruin the moment, Chris. No, but I think that's cool. I've had some of those moments with my kids too. They're a bit younger, but to be able to, the fact that she could open up to you and come talk to you, I think that says something about your relationship, right? Because there's probably times where she couldn't or she wouldn't.
Oh no, I mean.
And the fact that she did, like I mean, that's a testament to she feels safe around you, right?
It took time. I mean, it was a year after I was sober, and But I think what I didn't get from my dad when he got sober, I was in college. I didn't get amends. I didn't get any education on why he, and you know what, that I'm over that. You know, like you said, you have to learn to forgive people. I have that gracefully. Thank God, because I was able to move on. But it's really important if you've affected other people and they don't really understand alcoholism, or you have to let them talk. And, you know, there's nothing like a mother's love for their child. Yeah. But alcohol won for a while there. Yeah. No, you think, number one, I've got this beautiful baby and you love this baby more than anything in life. And at the end of the day, alcohol always wins. So I had to get out of my life, and now she's back as number one in my life, and I don't have to worry about that. Just a blessing.
So cool. I want to, before we get to rapid fire, I just want to ask, you know, you shared in the beginning some of the early childhood stuff, and I can see the correlation about like this, some struggles using 12 step or getting into 12 step. And yeah, I mean, there's like, it's pretty clear that there's a link there, right? I'm just curious, like how you were able to reconcile. And I say this, mm-hmm. I'm a 12 step guy. I think I've been pretty clear about that on the show, but also like I realize it's not for everybody, but there's probably some listeners who are like shaking their head, like, yes, yes, yes. This is why it's not for me. This is why it's not for me. Right. And this is not to say that it has to be for everybody. So we'll throw that little disclaimer out there, but, sure. How were you able to kind of reconcile the experiences of your past and be able to find a way, to find a home in the 12-step community?
Well, I was kind of at the end of my rope, for one. Like, I could go back to rehab, but I would just be prolonging. You know, I mean, AA was always like a recovery to live life. And I just like said, okay, well, this is what I have to do. And I went to new meetings. I didn't go to just big book meetings. I didn't even know there were any other types of meetings, because any meeting I ever went to just happened to be a big book meeting. And you read and read, and like the words, especially in the beginning, just my brain is so scattered. And one person talks for 20 minutes and then it's amen, Lord's Prayer, I'm out the door faster than anything. So I just had to give it a try. And I think it changed. I think it's changed a lot over the years. But I really think it's the meetings you find that you like and connect. So I go to a lot of topic AA meetings, and we just read the daily reflections. And then we just, whatever's on your mind. And then I started going to women's meetings, and I started to realize I have a choice. Not, you know, and that really opened my eyes. I also got a sponsor, and I told her about my childhood, and she goes, well, you know, you don't have to believe in that God. And I'm like, are you qualified to be a sponsor in this program? And she was the best thing that ever happened to me, because she had, you know, stuff in her past too with God. And I did the steps, but I learned to find other ways, like higher powers and nature. I mean, I have a crazy story about a white squirrel that we don't have time to get into, but I'm telling you, once you open your eyes and you see what's happening around you, that higher power is there, and it can be what you want to find it to be. It's beautiful once you get over it.
Yeah. It's tough. And like, I will acknowledge it's definitely written in like surf on the surface. Initial exposures, it's very much like an old white man's club religious group, mm-hmm. You know, I get that. But you look around, you keep going to meetings, you're like, I truly believe anybody can find a home there. But also there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot.
Well,
a lot,
I mean, Cafe RE, that community is beautiful also. I mean, I just love, the goal is let's try to stay sober, you know, let's not drink. Yeah. And I've met beautiful people in all of the communities. It's any, whatever you're attracted to, but I do believe in the steps, but it's everybody's own solution. And that's kind of what I needed to understand, is even though I really did it the AA way, I wanted to pretend like, oh, it's my way. I figured it out. Clearly you can't do it on your own. Yeah. I could not do it on my own.
Community is key. Tanya, we are, if you can believe it, at the rapid fire round.
Wow. I'm so not prepared. I don't even know these questions.
They are some hard hitters, so just get ready. I'll ask you to answer these in 30 to 60 seconds. Number one, what was your biggest fear as you were thinking about quitting drinking?
Well, I didn't know any other coping skills, so I thought I might just go crazy. And also for me, the physical withdrawal, it was hard. But I had gotten over any fear of like not going to weddings or vacations. I had ruined most of those events. So mine were more like emotional, like I gotta get new coping skills. Yeah. What am I gonna do?
That's good. What is a positive that you did not expect in a life without alcohol?
Well, I think like my life went from black and white to color. You know, I didn't know the beautiful, 15 years, I am a pretty substantial drinker and I'm going to work and I'm functioning. But when you allow yourself to see the beauty in life and you listen to these things and you're open to it, oh my gosh, it's, you know, life is long. And my family, it has a lot of long life in them, like 100+ years at all my family tree. So I'm so grateful that at 50, I've learned to see the beauty and the peace and what you can really have. And just stop thinking so much, you know, get out of your head. I'm my worst enemy. So I love that. It's just like everything just starts getting a little slower, makes more sense, and you see beauty.
I love it. What is your go-to alcohol-free drink?
Well, I still love caffeine, so coffee for sure with cream sugar. I should just call it cream with coffee, but I love coffee. And sparkling water, Diet Mountain Dew.
You're in good company. What is your favorite resource in recovery? This can be a book, an app, a in-person online community, anything, any resource that's been helpful to you.
Well, I will say the app Everything AA, because literally after COVID, 3 a.m, you can get on a meeting, and this app, you know, it tells you what time of day, where there's a meeting, a Zoom meeting. And like, I would listen to meetings. You don't even have to go on camera. And that was a great resource for me. And it tracks my sobriety and has other things in it. And it has the daily reflections, all my meditations that I read every morning. I just found that to be super helpful. And then over time, obviously, just getting into the community, both communities, AA and CAFARE, have been great.
Yeah, I love that. And just to find a quick resource that's the availability, these are your rapid fire questions, but I just want to like echo what you said. There's so much stuff and like the barrier for entry is so low, like just to be able to listen. You don't have to walk into a room. I think there's something powerful that happens when you do that, but just to be able to like listen and check things out, very, very cool.
Very, very needed and useful.
What parting piece of guidance can you give to our listeners who are either in early sobriety or thinking about recovery?
Well, one, I feel bad telling this to new people because I literally wanted to just punch people in the face when they said, Tanya, you got to give it time. Like, I don't have time. I've got to figure this out right now. But time, it has to happen. It's kind of a grieving process. And you just have to not drink for today. Like one day at a time. I didn't understand that. I got shit to do tomorrow. I cannot just not think about tomorrow. Well, it's not even about that. It's really just don't drink today. So I think in the beginning, it's daunting, it's overwhelming, but you know, find yourself to just really slowly say, I'm not gonna drink today, and set other goals and be very involved in community because you will not feel alone.
Yeah, time's a great healer. It's also crazy frustrating when you're in it, but that's all right.
It's the last thing you want to hear, but it works. It helps.
Yeah. Tanya, last but not least, can you give listeners your favorite, you might need to ditch the booze if line?
Oh my gosh. I don't even know. There's so many. I think probably you should ditch the booze when you are hiding your vodka in vacuum bags. I mean, my husband would never look there, but when you're starting to hide things in really weird places, vacuum bags and under sheets and in pillowcases, like right in the mattress, in robes. I mean, I'm buying these little Tito airplane bottles. They're all over the house. Strategically, that was my job for that year, is to hide alcohol. And I swear to God, 2 weeks ago, I found a half bottle of Svedka in the back of my filing cabinet in a file, like it was had its, like its own little file. So I think I got a little crazy about that. It's probably time.
That fun little just depressing Easter egg hunt. Vacuum bags, I gotta say, that is, I have not heard that one. That's brand new. And
yeah they'll never look there.
I would say it might be time. It could be time to ditch the booze.
Yes, Tanya, thank God.
Thank you for your time. Absolutely. Thank you for your vulnerability. And thank you for sharing your story. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. This was great for me and very, very fun. Lighthearted.
I appreciate you, sister. Recovery Elevator, thanks for listening. And thank you, Tanya, for coming on the show. You're going to help a lot of people today. This past weekend was my daughter's junior prom. I shared in Cafe RE the other day how she was 10 when I got sober, and it's absolutely insane to me that in a few months she's going to be entering her senior year of high school. When my kids were younger, people told me all the time to take it in because it won't last forever. As someone with a 17 and a 13-year-old, I'm that guy now. This is my quick reminder to you, RE, even if you don't have kids, to take it in. Life is screaming by, so do what you have to take some extra time to pause and enjoy where you are. Spend some time with gratitude, find something to be thankful about in the season of life that you're in, and breathe into it. Embrace the people in your life. Tell someone you love them. Spend time with the folks around you now. Recovery Elevator, we all go home, so we might as well go big. I love you guys.